Did you specifically point out coaches and athletic directors, because that's something that may not be normally part of their continuing education program? Or I'm just curious, because in more and more high schools, we're having athletic trainers that are seeing the athletes, and that the athletes are going to and asking for advice on that. And I'm just wondering why they weren't also called out in this.
Chair Buckley, Representative Krumbel, members of the committee, our studies indicate that of our 290 high schools, probably less than 25% have certified athletic trainers in the building. And some of those are full-time, many of those are just part-time. But the vast majority of our schools still don't have a certified athletic trainer on staff, either part-time or full-time. I think the thought behind this was that the people that are seeing these student athletes on a regular basis are the athletic directors and the coaches. We do have a coaches education program. However, it's a one-time program. We implemented that several years ago with support from the legislature, because we found that we have so many coaching positions that are now filled by non-licensed, quote, off-campus coaches. They come in the afternoon and coach our student athletes, but they're not part of the licensed teaching staff. So we have them go through a coaches education program, but right now it's a one-time requirement that they fulfill. The thought here was that certainly we're hearing about food supplements today that nobody had ever heard about 4 years ago, so that some kind of a periodic ongoing update, so that our coaches could be made aware of what's the current trend in food supplement steroid use, so that we could make them aware on a periodic basis as to what changes had come about and what things they ought to be looking for. And I think, again, Dr. Lynn Goldberg from OHSU, who will follow us, has some ideas on how that is to be implemented.
Okay. Representative Lynn.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm familiar with the bill last 2 years ago introduced. And could you identify what's the differences, the bills 2 years ago and the current, this Senate Bill 517? What's the differences in it? Anyone know?
I think everybody's looking at me again.
You're in the middle.
Chair Buckley, Representative Lim, the bill is very similar in nature, and I think one thing that I would like to remind members of the committee, and that is the bill doesn't outlaw food supplements. You can go into a general nutrition center, or you can go into 24-hour fitness, and you can buy food supplements over the counter that are totally legal. What the bill says is that none of those should be directed or recommended or provided by our high school coaches. I was at our medical aspects of sports committee meeting last night with nine doctors, and a local school in the Salem area, a doctor reported that this spring a baseball player was suffering renal failure because he had been ingesting creatine that had been suggested by the football coach last fall. Those are the things that we are trying to prevent, and we would appreciate your help in making that, you know, illegal in the state.
Chair Buckley, Representative Lim, let me say it's in my written testimony. It would add, the educational component is no, which is the bill would require school districts to include information on steroids and performance-enhancing supplements in their health and physical education curriculum, and also requires coaches and athletic directors to receive ongoing education prevention strategies for the use of steroids and performance-enhancing supplements. So, in other words, that's new. That's new from,
yes.
You've said that, but that specifically is new from what we did 2 years ago.
Okay. Follow
up. Representative Lim.
What I remember, Mr. President, you are correct. Last time we left out some of the groups, such as the volunteers, they are not included in it. Because of the reason I was responsible, one of the responsible legislators filling this bill. Because some of them included, but the volunteers and others, they can still sell it. So, but this bill covers everybody. So this is a good bill, and many others oppose it because of the same reason. I think this will pass unanimously, in my opinion, and it should be, and this is a good bill.
Thank you, Representative Lim. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of the high schools do a an adolescent risk factor behavioral study. Lynn might know the answer to this. Do you know whether steroids are included in that survey? Do we know what's the extent students use these? I'm getting a yes from the professor back there.
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, I would defer to our medical experts that I think can respond better to those questions. Thank you.
Representative Dahl.
Yes, I'd like to thank Senator Courtney for bringing this bill back. And I'm going to ask some questions, and I don't really care which one of the three of you answer, but I want these questions particularly vetted because I watched my colleague crumble last year on the floor. These are all the things I can think of that might be raised. One, when a parent is coaching, can they dispense food supplements, medication, steroids, anything to their own children, whether they're on the team or not? A parent. Well, I want the answer and I want it on the record.
Chair Buckley, Representative Dahlem, again, all eyes seem to be looking at me.
That's all we are.
I would think, you know, my response to that would be that when they're acting in the role of a coach at the school, they are acting in the role of a coach. What they do with their child in their own family setting, they're acting as a parent. But I don't think it would be appropriate.
Thank you very much, Tom.
That's a great answer.
When a coach is dispensing medicine or reminding a student athlete to take a prescription medication during practice, is that appropriate? And would this bill have any impact on that practice?
These are the questions that, and
these are the questions that brought her down.
This one with respect to insulin. This one is an insulin question.
Vice Chair Don, this specifically, by the way, steroids is new too. We added steroids.
Yes,
so steroids is new. We're not just picking on performance enhancing supplements. Steroids is new this session in terms of this bill, because there's some, I won't get into roids too much with you, but it's out there. You know, a prescription, you know, I don't know. I mean, you got a coach. They have a relationship with student athletes, and they're involved in their life in certain ways. They know what's going on with the health of their athletes. At least they should, in my opinion. I don't know why this bill doesn't cover that. It does not speak to that situation. I just have to tell you, I'm not ducking your question. It doesn't speak to that because I see the bill. It just doesn't. That's how I see the bill.
Let me cue it up different because I do want this answer. A student athlete is suffering from asthma, and the symptoms begin to manifest themselves. Can the coach say to the student, why don't you use your inhaler, or would you do the things you have to do, or can he do that?
Representative Buckley, Chair Bollum, and members of the committee, again, I'm not trying to evade your question, but I think our medical professionals would let you know whether that inhaler is covered under the terminology of food supplements and whether it's not. But I wouldn't want to provide the medical answer to that.
I'll hold that question until they come. And I can. Those were the two, I think, that really...
Insulin was an issue.
Oh, if I could. And I do want these on the record so that when Representative Roblin, if he carries the bill, I will help him.
We're not going to let Roblin
I want him to be able to say that we discussed that in committee, it was covered, and the answer is yay or nay. And so, if you'll permit me. I think that Representative Lim covered quite well, but this bill does cover volunteers also. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kahn.
Just a quick comment, Chair Buckley. Thank you for President Courtney. First of all, thank you for your persistence, diligence, and care for all of our students in many ways, and in particular, the training that you have mentioned and added to the bill. The program Athletes Targeting Healthy Exercise and Nutrition Alternatives, Athena. It was piloted in middle school in which I served, and the results were remarkable, and the pilot we had dealt with female athletes. And it was just a dramatic change in how our female students acted, behaved, ate, and all that other stuff. And my other thanks is that you didn't remove Tums from the list, because as staff was reading this, I was eating my Tums, and I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, is that performance enhancing? And I hope it was. But anyway. Sorry.
Thank you, Vice Chair Comp. Gentlemen, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson, could you please call up the
Miss? We have Dr. Lynn Goldberg, Dr. Thad Stanford, and Mr. John Mills.
Member, just a note where we are on time. The Speaker's office did remind me this afternoon that we have approximately 9 meeting days left for us to cover education bills this month on the full education committee. A lot of bills to get through. We have I want to get through at least 3 today, and so I'm going to try to. We have another panel to listen to, but if we can keep questions and answers concise, I would appreciate it. Thank you, members.
Chair, I do need to leave it to
Representative Greenlick. Thank you. Gentlemen.
Chair Buckley, Representative Dallin, Representative Comp. I'm Thad Stanford. I'm an orthopedic surgeon here in Salem at 3360 Croizon Creek Road, 97302. I come to speak again in favor of this bill. I chair the Medical Aspect of Sports Committee of the OMA, OSAA. I'm the immediate past chair of the National Federation of State High School Association Sports Medicine Advisory Committee. Dietary supplements in 1994 by Congress at the urging of some representatives from states where they are manufactured decided that the FDA would not be allowed to evaluate or control dietary supplements. They were to be called foods. And dietary supplements, according to them, may contain vitamins, minerals, herbs, other botanicals, amino acids, other substances meant to increase the total dietary intake, a concentrate, metabolite, or constituent, or extract. The result is that we now have a $2 or $3 billion a year industry, and this industry is largely self-regulated. The FDA is simply not allowed to study these things for their scientific value. The National Federation, which I mentioned, is an association of 51 state high school associations, some 18,000 schools, and some 7 million student athletes. In the handout, I have included 3 statements over the years that were made by the National Federation with regard to the issue we're talking to today. I only have 3 of the NCAA pamphlets left. I've been distributing them around, but the NCAA has a very strong opinion on this also. Many of these groups have gone to Congress to try to get these substances back under the FDA, and thus far have failed. Remember, ephedra was a supplement. Andro was a supplement until there were a lot of problems and young people were damaged, and then the FDA was allowed to manage those. You've heard how much influence coaches have. Coaches have incredible influence over their kids. We talked about a little bit, and I'm no expert on the inhaler, but if a child goes to school, Representative Comp would know this, and you're going to take an aspirin during school, they have to take it to the principal's office. Out on the practice field, you're never quite sure what's going on, those are things I think that we need to address. There are other problems. There's a sheet in here on the side effects and the way these substances can interact with prescription medicines. And the chart I've given you is five or 6 years old, and that could be quadrupled today easily with what we've learned. So the danger is hidden, and these kids simply don't know. The cost is huge. Kids are spending lots of money on these things. And we're teaching kids, if we encourage the use of these, to solve their problems with a pill. And what comes next? What pill comes next when they have a problem and all the kids have problems? And I think Dr. Goldberg will speak to that. There is an article in here that's quite scientific, but I think that if you're interested, it does get into many of the articles we see about these substances that show that they are harmful. I would only mention just briefly that the energy drinks that you read about are laced with various substances, including lots of caffeine, carbohydrates, etc. Kids are being hammered from all directions about performing better and using substances of some kind to enhance that performance. Our committee, medical aspect of sports committee, is represented well by the trainers who concur with our approach. So, and that's the end of my statement.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Goldberg. Great. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you. Hi, Chair Buckley and Vice Chairs Dallum and Comp and members of the committee. On behalf of OHSU, I'm honored to speak to you about Bill 517A, a legislation designed to protect and improve the health of Oregon students from K through 12. My background is that I'm a physician. I'm head of the Division of Health Promotion and Sports Medicine. I'm happy to say I was co-principal investigator of the Athena program and was the principal investigator of the Atlas program, both model programs. And I testified in the famous or infamous steroid hearings in Capitol Hill twice in 2005 for baseball and the NFL. Happy to say that the NFL is now backing our programs for 20,000 kids this year. Sports Illustrated backed our program and four are going on in Oregon for $15,000 15,000 kids this year who are having the programs implemented. I've worked with high school coaches and athletes for over 20 years. One of the schools that I'm working with now is French Prairie in our diabetes prevention program using similar behavioral techniques, also with the Gresham School District and Salem School District as well. So I'm very familiar with what goes on in the schools. I think that this program this bill is very important to helping kids today in Oregon and would be a model for all other states. It's important to remember that the bill does not ban supplements. It does not ban sports supplements. It disallows school personnel from recommending them. It outlines the most appropriate response to the widespread use of sports supplements and steroids for youth, including the best weapon, which is state-of-the-art education. In all due respect to Senator Courtney, I'm the principal investigator of the only NIH study that ever looked at drug testing. And I will tell you right now that drug testing is very feeble in its approach and its effectiveness. It's very expensive. To test one student for steroids, you could educate 12 kids in either Atlas or Athena, and we know that those effects can last for years beyond high school. Our latest data is up to 3 years afterwards, and we have still a greater than 50% reduction in supplements, diet pills, marijuana, and alcohol. So education works. Drug testing does not work very well. It works a little bit, and then it stops working when the student is out from under the guise of drug testing. It gives them no tools to refuse drugs in the summer, on vacations, or any other time. So I hope we don't go down the same road as other states are considering and use the best evidence, which are really science-based education, which actually does work. So I'm here to tell you then, and to Representative Greenlick, is that approximately in the last two renditions of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey regarding anabolic steroid use, there's been approximately 1 in 16 and 1 in 20 students, high school students, who admit to having used anabolic steroids. Not cortisone or corticosteroids, anabolic muscle-building steroids that are illegal. The Blue Cross Blue Shield has found over a million high school athletes admit to using supplements as well. And they don't know what these supplements do, and they don't know the side effects of steroids, Ephedra, which is now banned, or other supplements. So this bill will educate coaches and help protect our students.
Thank you, Doctor.
Chairman Buckley, Vice Chair Comp, and Vice Chair Dahlem, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to be here today. My name is John Mills. I'm the Director of Quality and Compliance at Highland Laboratories, a vitamin and supplement manufacturer located in Mount Angel, Oregon. I'm here to support the bill, not necessarily in its current wording, but definitely support the intent of the bill. We believe very strongly that anabolic steroids and certain performance enhancing supplements are not in the purview of our youth. It's just not responsible for us as adults to be giving these things to children. That's our viewpoint. That's our stand. That's the stand of the Natural Products Association, which is our major representative in Washington, D.C. The problem we have with the bill, we support the intent of the bill. The problem we have with the bill is the wording and the definitions. That is the only place we have an issue. And maybe I misread the bill. When Mr. Olson read the bill at the presenting, he stated performance-enhancing supplements, and I read in the bill 517A, performance-enhancing substance. So just as a case of point, a performance-enhancing substance is different than a performance-enhancing supplement. A performance-enhancing substance can go beyond a supplement. If you want to look at some of the most current health issues that are associated with our athletes is they use human growth hormone. Human growth hormone is not necessarily covered in the way the bill is currently worded in its definitions. And so we're recommending that two changes occur in the definition state, which would tighten that and give it more strength as far as addressing the issues associated with our youth. In the first section, under number one, we recommend that the change be stated as anabolic steroid includes all substances listed in the Anabolic Steroid Control Act of 2004. That's under number one, period. It just states that exclusively. And then under number two, we're recommending that under performance-enhancing substance, that the definition be changed to performance-enhancing substance means a manufactured product for oral ingestion, intranasal application, or inhalation containing compounds that are listed in the World Anti-Doping Code, the WADA list, that have not been previously exempted by the Anabolic Steroid Control Act of 2004. Unless a medical exemption is granted. Some of our students who take insulin require insulin. Under the WADA list, they would be denied that because insulin is currently used as a performance-enhancing substance, not supplement. You can't buy it in any health food store. You have to buy it, you know, through or take it from your parents or whoever has a diabetic around you. So we're recommending that these changes be made so that it can be tightened up a little bit more. There is opportunity for our students just to utilize products which are totally inappropriate in that respect. You start taking insulin on a regular basis, and you're going to create some dependencies later on down the road. You end up messing up your own system. Now, this would allow us to do that. The WADA list, by the way, is also a list which has analytical procedures that have been established for them. So your students can be tested at a later date, as Senator Courtney would like to see, and you would have definite results from that. I concur entirely with both doctors who sit with me in that Red Bull and other such things, which are touted on TV and commercials as being totally inappropriate. Way too much caffeine in the products for the children to be using. Or way too much caffeine, in my opinion, for an adult to be using. But in any case, the idea is that these stimulatory products, that overexcite the heart in that respect, are inappropriate. And yet they're readily available for every student. And you see the commercials on TV which drive a student. I mean, every Red Bull commercial puts wings on you. I mean, soccer players, baseball players, whatever. So it's just our opinion, the MPA, that if the wording was changed and to reflect in those two definitions, that we would be 100% in support of this particular bill.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. Mr. Olson wants to make one clarifying statement.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Mills, for pointing out the issue of substance versus supplement. Members of the committee, there is a mistake in the staff measure summary where I was reading from the summary of the bill. It's not the actual language. It should read substance where it reads supplement. The bill was amended on the Senate side to change that from supplements to substances throughout the bill, and the staff measure summary does not reflect that change, so my apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Chairman Buckley, Vice Chairman Comp, Vice Chairman Dolan, may I make one more comment, please?
Yes.
A point of clarification.
Sure.
In regards to FDA and regulation of the Natural Products Association or other dietary supplement manufacturers, my particular facility is registered as a dietary supplement manufacturer. We also hold a license in the state of Oregon to manufacture drug products. We, under the dietary supplement manufacturer's license through FDA, because we had to register with FDA, received four investigations, FDA investigations in our facility. We did not have a Form 43 filed against us, which is like a speeding ticket a cop would give you down the road. That's a Form 483 for the FDA. We did not receive one violation in those four investigations. Our industry is regulated by FDA. If you go to www.fda.gov and look on the left-hand column, it is one of the first three things listed as being regulated by FDA. So that's a common misconception that I'd just like to have corrected on the record, sir. I appreciate it. So just very quickly, did you bring these concerns to the Senate when they were hearing this bill?
We did attempt to do that, yes, and yes, I did testify in committee hearing at that time.
Thank you very much. And my understanding of the bill is that this bill is concerning school district employees, administrators, teachers, or other person employed, a person who volunteers, or person performing service on behalf. It doesn't apply to the student themselves. So
no, it doesn't. And that's not our concern here. Our concern is with the definition that you're working with. The definition goes beyond a specific bill. The definition applies to other bills that will come in line behind it. And that's where our concern arises with this. We completely agree that our student bodies do not need to be subjected to inappropriate guidance by uneducated or untrained individuals. We completely concur with that.
Thank you very much. Members, questions? Representative Greenlick?
Yes. Do you label your products not appropriate for...
I'm sorry?
You said your products aren't generally appropriate for children. I wonder if you label them.
Oh,
not appropriate for children.
Chairman Buckley, Representative Greenlick, I apologize for that. I may have stated in such a way that you misheard me. We have one product which we label as inappropriate for children to use, and that is DHEA. That is on all of our labels, inappropriate for individuals under 30 years old.
Thank you very much. Representative Lim?
Yes, and thank you very much. Why the Senate side didn't change the definition like you suggested? What's the reason they didn't do that?
Chairman Buckley, Representative Lim, the reason we asked the definition to be changed is that definitions have a tendency to cross over into other bills. For instance, we're referring at this time to the Anabolic Steroid Control Act of 2004. At some point in time, we may have someone referring to the Oregon State Bill number 517A as a definition reference. So that's the reason we're asking for the definition reference. Another reason is that in tightening up the use of the specific verbiage, especially in regards to performance-enhancing substance, then you're looking at branching out past supplements and going into actual substances, human growth hormone, which is a medical product, insulin-like growth factor, luteinizing hormone. These things are not typically available as supplements. They're more available in the medical industry. But they could be abused by children. Just as anabolic steroids are not available, these products are potentially available in some respects.
Thank you. Clarification, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim?
My question was why the Senate didn't amend the way you ask it.
Oh, right. Representative Buckley, Representative Lim. I don't know.
That's a good answer.
Thank you. Dr. Noble, would you like to comment?
Can I make a couple comments? One is that in contradistinction, what was just said, the supplement industry is not regulated like the pharmaceuticals are, and that's under the Deshaies Act in 1994. And if you think that it is, that's living under a delusion. when the International Olympic Committee did a study of over 600 supplements in the United States, over 18% of them were laced with anabolic steroids or their precursors. There have been study after study. I'm not talking about your supplement company or anyone else's supplement company, and many have been fined because what's on the label isn't necessarily what's in the product. And this can go from ginseng to ephedra, and the FDA does not have the wherewithal to regulate that industry and what's in the product. And some of these products, like ephedra, literally have to kill people before they're taken off the shelves. Right. Stephen Beckler was one of the problems. When Stephen Beckler, the athlete from Southern Oregon,
right,
died, it was because of ephedra. And that's what got it taken off the market, even though other people had died, had strokes, and had heart attacks from those problems with that drug.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. Members, are there any kind of wrap-up questions? Representative Allen?
Mine is for Dr. Stanford, and what I want to say about the bill is a yes or no. If I were to mix this bill with somebody administering prescribed medicine as opposed to not suggesting, I would be mixing apples and oranges. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Colonel.
Thank you. Either Dr. Stanford, nice to see you again, or Dr. Goldberg, would there be a reason to add injectables to this bill?
Injectables, if you're going to use human growth hormone, which was mentioned, injectables, it's the only way human growth hormone can be taken. Also, it's one that cannot be assessed by a drug test.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate your time and your willingness to be here to testify on the bill today. Mr. Olson, correct me if I'm wrong. I think that completes our list.
Yes, that does, Mr. Chair. Is there
anyone else here who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 517A? Seeing none, members, we are in a work session. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I move that Senate Bill 517A be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dahl, moving to Senate Bill 517A to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Representative,
it's a good deal, but I just want to comment, and we need to teach our children building the character instead of the body, and the education is very important part, but I just want to mention that.
Thank you, Representative. For the discussion, hearing none, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Excuse
me.
Well, you're there still. Sorry about that.
I'm excused.
Phoenix and
I was awake.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. The motion carries. I request from Representative Crimmel to carry this bill. And
would this be appropriate for the consent agenda?
I think it's a great place.
That's a good try there. That's actually not a bad idea, to tell you the truth. Is there opposition to having this in the consent agenda?
Oh,
too controversial.
I don't know if...
All right, I've got two members say it's going to be too controversial. Representative Crimmel would like you to carry the bill, and best of luck with it. And Representative Greenlick will back you
I'll
up.
I'll be there to help you, too. Oh, I absolutely.
Just
sure, you get to carry it with all that experience.
Yeah.
Roblin's as green as the grass.
That's amazing.
Well, I think it's important that we clarify for our colleagues that were here last session about the changes in the bill, the education, that was taken to heart, and it's there, it's needed, and so I think we can hopefully we can help minimize the questions on the floor.
Thank you, Representative.
Martin's really carrying.
He's a carrier.
He can't ask himself questions.
That question
could
be an
opportunity.
He's a carrier. Does that mean him questions or the bill?
Members, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 318A. I'm sorry, my administrator has changed my mind. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 318A. The request from the administrator was to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 214A. Sorry, Mr. Olson, for jumping around.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think there's only one witness signed up.
Great.
Perhaps would be a brief bill. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 214A requires public charter schools operated by school districts to be nonprofit organizations. It requires all or all new or existing public charter schools that are operated by school districts meet this requirement if they open or renew charters after July 1st, 2007. Specifically exempts one school district, declares an emergency, and takes effect July 1st, 2007. There's a technical amendment brought by the Employment Department just to correct an oversight in the law. They are here if there's any questions, and I believe we have a representative of the Department of Education. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Earl. So I'm trying to move so fast. I've excused Representative Greenlick, and I'm jumping bills as well. Mr. Earl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen, Department of Education. And Senate Bill 214 is meant to be affixed to an unintended consequence to the charter school law that was passed by this body in 2003. And as I'm sure most members of this committee know, in Oregon, charter schools must meet the requirements of ORS 338-035 to operate. And when the original charter school was passed, in recognition for the increased flexibility that our charter schools received, language was put into statute that would provide for greater accountability and make sure there were controls in place to make sure those public dollars were spent wisely. And part of this language that is included in 338035 included that the charter school be approved by a sponsor, whether that's a school district or the State Board of Education, that the charter school be established as a nonprofit organization to provide accountability for public dollars, and that that charter school had applied for 501c3 tax-exempt status. The statute was amended in 2003 to exempt charter schools specifically operated by a school district from these rules because it was believed that it was already clear that a school district is a tax-exempt organization, and there was a concern that this might create extra paperwork and burden for a school district to prove that they're a tax-exempt organization when it's already pretty clear in Oregon law. But this had an unintended consequence, and that unintended consequence was it deleted the requirement that the charter school have a separate governing body, a nonprofit board. So in essence, this means a charter school can be approved, sponsored, and governed by a contract executed by the same district school board acting as both sponsor and charter. So essentially, it'd be like writing a business contract to yourself. If you had a business and you also wanted to purchase things from your business, essentially, the district is the signer on both sides of the contract. And this led to a court ruling, which is attached to the testimony, and I'm going to read some language to you. The judge ruled that, quote, these provisions seem to imply, and he's referring to the ORS 338035 here, excuse me, these provisions seem to imply the need for two legally distinct entities, a sponsor and a charter governing body. But the plain text of ORS 338035-2B specifically contemplates situations where a local school may legally operate a public charter school, and no provision explicitly prohibits this relationship. So we're asking for the corrections in Senate Bill 214 to guarantee that all charter schools are created by the agreement between two separate and distinct legal entities. This guarantee will ensure better checks and balances and prevent school districts and boards from signing charter school contracts with themselves. And a couple of other quick relevant facts. The department is not aware of any current charter schools that have this sort of thing where the board is both the sponsor and the operator of the charter school, and they've signed contracts with themselves. The bill was amended in the Senate side to address concerns with some of the small school districts like Camas Valley and Santa Cruz District, Paisley School District, these single building school districts where it may be difficult to actually find a group of citizens that want to serve on a nonprofit board. Here's another interesting fact that we're asking for this, is that any charter school that is chartered and operated by the same school district and does not have a separate nonprofit board is not eligible for federal charter school grant monies. So if they're operating and they're the charter, they can't get federal grant money for their charter school. And we know there's no opposition to this bill from the charter school proponents. It's supported by the Oregon School Boards Association, passed the Senate on a 26-1 vote. And I know there's some amendments from the Employment Department, and I'm familiar that they exist and I know why they exist, but I'm not the right person to answer questions about those. But I'd be happy to answer any questions about 214.
Thank you, Mr. Earl. Members, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
So I want to make sure that I understand this correctly. If a charter school has its own board, and it's the operating board or the governing board for that for that charter school. If that board then contracts with another entity that is a profit-driven entity, is that going to be allowed under this bill?
Yes. What this would prohibit would be that if the school district board chartered the school, they then can't be the ones that operate the school at the same time. They would have to have a separate and distinct nonprofit board. And whether that separate and distinct nonprofit board is made up of same members of that of the school board, that's okay. But there needs, we believe that this was an unintended consequence that sort of created this exemption in law, and that's what we're trying to fix here, not any of the additional contracts that would occur between charter schools and other bodies. So.
And follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. And it is your testimony that there are not any charter schools currently in the state that are affected by this statute change.
Chair Buckley and Representative Crummell, I'm pinch-hitting today for Randy Harnish and Joni Gillis, who are really the charter school experts in our department, and I specifically contacted Mr. Harnish before the hearing today. They're up in Portland at a long-scheduled conference and said, are we aware of any charter schools right now that operate this way? And he said no.
Yes, I want to go back to the Paisley example, and we have many small school districts that are looking to charter themselves, if you will, in an attempt to remain viable. Will that option still be open to them?
My understanding, Chair Buckley and Representative Dahlm, from the specific language in the bill, and I'm going to turn to it very quickly here, on the A. and Gross version of Senate Bill 214, lines 16 and 15 through 17 says, notwithstanding paragraph A of the subsection, the requirements of paragraph A, B, and C of this subsection do not apply to a school in a school district that is composed of only one school. And there was some debate back and forth in the Senate Education Committee with the OSPA charter school proponents and the members of the committee, and it was decided that that was a reasonable exemption for those very small school districts that only have one school that this provision would be a burden. So it would only apply to those. So if a school district had, you know, four or five schools, they would not be exempted from that requirement to have a separate nonprofit board.
So far, so good. What does one school mean? For example, some of our schools that are looking at this have a high school and an elementary across the street down the block. Are they eligible?
Chair Buckley and Representative Dahl, my recollection of the committee hearing was that there was some discussion is when we say one school, are we talking about one specific building or, you know, multiple buildings on one piece of property? And if my recollection serves me that this would, if you had multiple buildings on a property, that you would be okay under this bill is my recollection from the Senate discussion.
Kind of fine follow-up. Representative Dahl, if they're not on one property but on two ends of town, are they eligible?
Chair Buckley and Representative Dahlm, that issue was not raised in the Senate, and I would need to check with the Legislative Council to answer that question specifically.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions, Mr. Allen? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Allen, for your testimony today. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 214A? There are not. Members, there is a proposed amendment. I want to give you a minute to read it on 214A. It's a -3 amendment. Please, Mr. Olson.
Members of the committee, just a clarification. This amendment comes at the request of the Employment Department to correct a technical oversight in the law and has the concurrence of the Department of Education. Would not change my understanding from talking to the Employment Department, who's here in case there's further questions. Wouldn't change really anything that's being done currently. It just clarifies in the law this is an aspect that applies to charter schools as well, but would not have any immediate impact. It's more of a technical fix on something that was an oversight.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. I would assume that the mentions of the Certificate of Initial Mastery and Certificate of Advanced Mastery in the amendments will be deleted upon passage of the other bill that we've heard earlier this session.
Right. My understanding is Legislative Council is just, I mean, that's drafted because that's how the existing law reads, but it would be in cleanup when based on other bills as they become law.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And it does also on page 2, lines 9. Where was that? Where did I find it? There is a waiver ability.
exhausted.
Oh, it's on page 1, lines 8 through 15. State Board of Education may grant a waiver of any provision of this
right.
chapter. Just yes. calling your attention to that.
It only adds the one section of law, Mr. Chair. It doesn't make any other changes to the overall way the law is implemented or applies.
Representative Dahl?
I didn't find the line you were reading, Chair Buckley. I think this may cover me, but I'd like some time to look that over. If the definition of a school is on one property, but this says that that there's a waiver process, I'd like to be certain that those two aren't in conflict with one another. I do have several small schools in House District 59 that are definitely looking to the charter school process as a way to survive, particularly if the small schools legislation should languish.
The waiver language, Representative, page or on the amendment, page 1, line starting line 8, would allow the state board to waive any provision of the chapter if the waiver promotes the development of programs or providers, enhances equitable access by underserved families to public education of choice, extends equitable access to public support. I believe that waiver would be in play for the schools you're referring to. I'm not sure if there's anyone at this that we can get. Would you like to try to get Ledge Council?
Well, this is the same provision that Representative Cannon and I read.
Right.
I'm sure it was 10 times, but I would like to know that that's covered. If you want to move the bill today, otherwise I could go check that myself. Either way,
if Ledge Council is available, we'll go ahead and have Ledge Council come and pay us a quick visit.
Oh, the reason why that has to be in there, Mr. Chair, in terms of looking at this, is because at the very end of that piece of the statute, it says the State Board of Education may not waive any appeal provision of this chapter or any provision under ORS 338115-1A2P,
mm-hmm.
and P is being deleted and Q is being put in because with the addition of ORS Chapter 657, Employment Department Law, that becomes Q.
Oh, very good.
So that is why Section 3 is in there, because that part of the statute has to be amended to include A to Q instead of A to P.
Thank you, Representative Grillo.
And I'm looking it up, and the department chapter 657, which I had a concern about what this really is all of the unemployment insurance law and all of that kind of stuff.
So, Mr. Olson, confirm once again.
Mr. Chair, Cindy Hunt from Legislative Council was listening to our hearing and was almost out the door when I called her, so she will be up here.
So you slowed her down.
Oh, you slowed her down. Out of the cloud. Mr. Chair,
yes.
While we're waiting, I move that the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 214A.
Representative Dahl has moved the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 214A. Is there any further discussion on the amendments? Any opposition? Seeing none, so amended. Thank you, Representative Dahl, and we'll get your question answered ASAP here.
Thank you for your patience.
Can we stand in recess? Our legal counsel has arrived. Thank you so much. And if you identify yourself, Representative Dahlem has a question.
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem?
Yes, Ms. Hunt, the question, Cindy, if you don't mind. I've been in her office more than I've been in my own lately. The question is, with Senate Bill 214, we have, with the rural and necessary schools, rural and remote schools that you helped me write the definition of, some schools that have buildings on adjacent property or properties from one end of town to the other. These small schools, are looking at becoming charter schools in order to stay alive. Would this, with its definition of school, preclude that from happening? The definition, we were told, is a school with one building, I believe.
Or on one property.
Or a school with all its buildings on one property.
Chair Buckley, Representative Dahlem. So the section of the bill that you're looking at is the exclusion that's talking about a school in a school district that is composed of only one school.
Yes.
And your instance involves schools on more than one piece of property?
I asked the Department of Ed, what does the definition of school mean? And the first definition was a school in one building. And then the definition was amplified to say a school with all its buildings on one property. And so the follow-up question would be, and there are several that have an elementary school and a high school, or at least one building with some combination of lower grades and another building with some combination of higher grades. Would this preclude them from asking for charter status?
Oh, Chair Buckley, Representative Dahlem, no. I think I misunderstood your first question. No, because under this bill, they could still ask for charter status, because the only thing that this bill does is talk about how B and C don't apply to a school in a school district that's composed of only one school, but it doesn't prohibit them from asking for charter status. If you are in a school district that only has one school, you don't have to meet the requirements of being organized as a nonprofit organization and being exempt from 501c3 of the IRS code. So if you are only one school, you have, if you will, less requirements to meet to become a charter school.
Okay, and we're looking at the situation, and Paisley serves as a model. They saw their salvation in turning to a charter school. They made their own board, the charter school board and the public school board. So they, in essence, chartered with themselves. Mm-hmm. This law says that you can't charter with yourself. And that became the question. Then the next question was, well, it does exempt a school or with one school. We got into that, and that's how we got into that definition. So what I want to be crystal clear on, and perhaps I should have framed the question in the larger issue, we have schools that are smaller number. I believe the definition is less than 112 or 100, something like that, that are looking very much at becoming a charter. But they are on a couple of campuses. The school board would charter with itself, by virtue of the size of the community. Is that precluded? Can that still happen?
Yeah. Chair Buckley, Representative Dahlem, within the charter school law, there is not per se a definition of what a school is. What we do have is the State Board of Education has the ability to adopt rules. And if the court were to look at it, so for example, say a situation like what you just said, and the school was to be sponsored and someone thought that that wasn't appropriate, or the Department of Ed did, what the court would look at is the plain language of the statute. What does it mean to be a school? What did the 1999 legislature mean when it passed the charter school law when it was talking about a school? So the examples that you gave, in that a school within a building, well, that's probably a school. A school, multiple buildings on one property. I can think of examples that that's a school. When you start getting off of one property, because I think in your description you talked about an elementary school and a high school, then in that case that may in fact be two schools, and this exemption may not necessarily apply to them. But I should also point out in this bill there's two other provisions I think of relevance to this discussion. One is that the provisions of this don't apply until those existing charters renew their charter, so within the next 5 years. So it doesn't apply immediately. Or, and it also applies to charter schools that began operation on or after the effective date. So there's that. And also, there's also the waiver provision still in the statutes that the state board could implement.
Representative Dolan, would you like me to close the hearing on this bill and give you some time to study this? It seems like this is the one issue that's holding up. Representative Roblin?
Yeah, just two things I want to mention to this one. I agree with your definition. In fact, I can make a case that there are places that have multiple schools in the same building. If I were a small school, I would want to have two schools because each one is eligible for the $250,000 from the federal government when they apply for their charter status. If you have one school, it's not. It's only one, and they get the one bite at the apple, and they don't get two bites at the apple. And the real deal that the school district has to make is if they are that small, then put them all in one building and call it a K-12 school. That's their choice. They can do it anytime they want, if there's the room for it. I mean, that's the issue. So, you know, from my perspective, we can talk around this for these people, but the real issue is the structure of this the right thing? And I tend to think it is. And if there's individual cases for some of these small schools, the state school board is going to have to help make that decision, and they have the ability to waive. So I feel pretty good. And if I'm looking at it as a school board person, and I want to have an elementary school, and I want to have a high school, and I have them separate, I want both those to get the startup money and the funding that you can get from the federal government. That's going to keep me afloat a lot longer than just one bite at the apple.
I think with one question, we can either move on or I'll ask for some more time.
Representative Dahl.
I have a small school, 76 kids, K to 12. They're in two separate buildings. This does not preclude them from becoming a charter school with their school board as the managers of the charter.
Correct. Chair Buckley, Representative Dallum, that's correct, because you could still have, for example, a nonprofit entity that would enter into the charter with the school board, but then that nonprofit entity can contract with the school district to manage the school. For example, the school district could be the employer of the employees in that charter school.
I'd like to look at this just a little bit more. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate your help. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing work session on Senate Bill 214, another one that Mr. Olson said would be easy.
Who's counting?
I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 318A. Mr. Olson, if you would be kind enough to read about the bill, and Senator Walker, if you were here, and Senator Winters as well. Welcome to our committee. Glad to have you here, and Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 318, A, as it came to us from the Senate, changes the list of activities for school district grants awarded from the School Improvement Fund, directs the Department of Education to establish monetary rewards for school districts and programs that show extraordinary progress towards student achievement goals, declares an emergency, and is effective July 1st, 2007. The committee has before it three different amendments. The A9 amendment, I'm going to summarize, this is all more details in your staff measure summary. The A9 amendment adds education service districts and does a number of other things. It deletes the provision language about meeting the goals of increased student achievement, deletes the provision setting aside money for monetary rewards for school districts demonstrating progress above the student achievement goals, brings the language back to the language in the original law with only a report once a biennium rather than yearly reports, clarifies that the money will be given out among all the schools applying, likewise among all the ESDs applying, and sets up a percentage for how that works, and deletes language rolling over unused funds to the next fiscal year. So it has a number of changes. The A10 amendment has all those changes, but does not include education service districts. So any language that deals with that is not in the A10. The A11 language adds language directing the State Board of Ed to consider the prioritizations as well as the recommendations from the Quality Education Commissions, and adds a requirement for local matching grants from sources other than the School Improvement Fund when the school district or program share is based on the following activities, and basically says if activities that have demonstrated positive effect on student achievement through scientifically based research, matching grants are not required. All other activities, school district must come up with 20% matching funds. This amendment also, like the A9, A10, will clarify that the distribution of money available is for distributed among the programs and school districts that qualify for the grants. So I hope that made sense. The text of the amendments is before you, members of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Senators, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, and thank you, Chair Buckley, for the record, I'm Senator Jackie Winters, and I represent Salem, Monmouth, Independence, Almsville, and Turner. I'm here today just to explain that I voted yes on Senate Bill 318, and I did so because I believe that any program to increase student achievement should be considered in our school funding. Since that vote, however, I have been reminded of the legislative intent behind the School Improvement Fund, and I feel it is my duty to bring it to your attention as well. Looking back through documentations of discussions and amendments and final passage of House Bill 2298, which I carried successfully on the House floor in 2001, I found that our directions were, in fact, for targeted use of funds to early age initiatives. In Section 4 of House Bill 2298, we specifically stated that for the 2001-2003 and the 2003-2005 biennia, the department was limited to awarding grants for activities that related to improved student performance on third and fifth grade reading and mathematics assessments. Exceptions were only to be made for schools already making significant progress. And as you well know, the funding we provided for that first biennium was stripped away during our economic, you can call it downturn or economic hard times, but we were in very bad economic straits in our state. And nothing was ever funded the next biennium. Hence, our goal of targeting early reading and math improvements was never achieved. I have provided to each of you the staff measure summary for House Bill 2298 in 2001. As you can see, we discussed early childhood support and the importance of reading in the early grades to the later success of students. As background to our discussion, we noted that the governor, the Quality Education Commission, and the Speaker's Education Leadership Team all recommended targeting funds towards kindergarten to fifth grade literacy. Additional committee amendments added that the department would ensure accountability of school districts for the grant funds by providing assistance, appropriate interventions, and consequences to support progress towards performance goals. Further amendments added a three-year time frame as a goal for meeting performance targets. Now, I can't help but wonder if the legislature was right in its targeting of funds and required accountability for school districts receiving grants. You know, then in 2001 and 2003. Clearly, the Chalkboard Project has shown us that the early age investments continue to be the biggest bang for the buck in student achievement. I can still recall having some conversation with Governor Kitzhaber on early childhood, and I reminded him during that time when we were having this discussion that Logan would soon be three. And if those of you who know, Logan is the governor's son, and that we need to prepare Logan just like we need to prepare other children in our state. Fact is, we knew it before they did, and we sent the same message in 2001 that they are now sending now. And no doubt, in those 6 years, the public's cry for increase in student achievement and the need for targeted investment with accountability has only gotten louder.
I ask you to consider our original intent for the School Improvement Fund. Consider adding language targeting these funds to early age investments of reading, tutors, and class size reductions, and think twice before expanding the use of dollars beyond what for years we have known would make students better and the public's trust in our schools and in us even higher. I don't think that there's any secret in this building since I arrived here in 99 that I very much support early childhood education. That's been one of my passions, including others that have to do with children. But I do believe that, you know, when we may have these discussions in 2001, that they were relevant then just as they are relevant today. And I felt that I would be remiss if I did not come before you and to actually provide you with the documentations and the discussion that we had in 2001, which led to the creation of the funds. And if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I think if you have a little bit of time, we'll have Senator Walker speak here too before questions.
Great. Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. I appreciate the history that Senator Winters has given you about the School Improvement Fund, and I value her opinions. Senator Winters served with me on the Senate Commission on Educational Excellence, where we were divided into work groups. Senator Winters was on the work group for early childhood education. I was on the accountability work group. And in the accountability work group, I brought forward this document from Pennsylvania called the Accountability Block Grant Program. Pennsylvania passed this law in 2000, implemented it in 2004, and as we began discussing it, and it's extremely similar to what we're talking about right now in Senate Bill 318, so in the process of discussing this program, and what was absolutely wonderful about this is that Eileen Flynn worked for the Pennsylvania Governor's Office, the Department of Education, where Vicki Phillips, the Superintendent of Public Schools, was Secretary of Education. And Eileen was the drafter of the Accountability Block Grant Bill. So when I brought this forward, I was given this last legislative session. I was handed this because I was curious about it. I'd heard about it, and I reviewed it. And so when we were appointed to this commission, I brought this forward to our work group. And we started discussing it, and Paul Warner was staffing our work group, and I believe it was Paul who said, well, this sounds like the School Improvement Fund that we already have in statute. So we pulled the School Improvement Fund out, and we decided that this fits very nicely into the School Improvement Fund, and we can make that School Improvement Fund better. It wasn't all that clearly defined in the statute according to our work group on the Senate Commission on Educational Excellence. So we spent a great deal of time, several months, working on this project and came forward with a final draft, and that's what you had with Senate Bill 318 in the beginning. In my Senate Education Committee, we did remove a couple of sections that were put in there that at the last minute, while I was not at the last meeting because I was rather busy, but there was a section in there requiring an investment of 25% by local districts. When we took our committee to Reedsport, and Representative Roblin knows exactly what I'm talking about, our committee went to Reedsport, and we had several, oh my gosh, the auditorium was filled with hundreds of people from all up and down the South Coast to testify about education-related issues, and this bill was up for hearing and discussion. And we heard from those local, very cash-poor, cash-strapped, underserved districts that Senate Bill 318 with the 25% clause in it would make it extremely difficult for them to compete and get any of the grant monies that were available. So I jerked that out and it made all of Representative Roblin's constituents happy, which I was happy to do since I graduated high school in Reedsport, Oregon. Go Brave. And there were a couple of other minor amendments. Chalkboard did come in to our committee and tell us that they wanted to do things differently, and I think that's what you see in the A11 amendments, and our committee did not support it. Our committee felt that what we did in Senate Bill 318 was very expansive and also quite narrow. We gave districts, our goal was to provide districts the flexibility to do what they needed to do. For instance, while I appreciate and understand we all care about early childhood education, some districts are doing quite well with early childhood education, and they need money in other areas. Maybe they need money for English as a second language. Maybe they need money for mentoring and teacher retention, or any number of areas, programs to improve student achievement gap, vocational educational programs, literacy programs. So this was meant to give people a broad array of programs to choose from and not limit them. Because the one thing that you hear from local school districts is they hate it when the legislature acts like the super school board. And they want the flexibility to do what they need. So if we can target those dollars, and we provide, it says, research-based student improvement strategies. So the Dash 11 amendments, I don't even want to go there because I think this bill has been well vetted. I think we passed off the Senate floor with 25 yes votes and 3 no votes. It was a very large margin. It was well vetted in the interim. The commission was a very large group of people. There were several legislators on it, but there were also community members and business leaders. And we all talked about all of these issues and agreed to introduce these bills as we see them today with the change in the 25% rule. So I think we've done an excellent job in providing the flexibility. There was a fiscal on this bill that no one seemed to know about except the Department of Ed that wasn't shared with anyone else. So you see in the amendments before you today in either the Dash 9s or the Dash 10s that we take care of that fiscal by eliminating the problem that created the fiscal, and we will deal with that in a budget note in the department's budget. So I think we take care of all of those things, and this is a huge win for education in Oregon. We have finally decided that we can fund the school improvement fund. It's a new and improved school improvement fund. I'm all about, you know, trying to make things work, but as you implement them, if you find they can do better, well, that's so be it. And we got a lot of feedback in the work groups, as Senator Winters knows. Our work groups met in depth. And in fact, the recommendation of the Commission on Educational Excellence was to fully fund Head Start. And that's why you didn't see any bill come across from my side of the building to fully fund kindergarten. I'm sorry, but my committee made a decision based on the work of the Senate Commission on Educational Excellence that we were going to put our early learning dollars into fully funding Head Start before we fully fund kindergarten. So there are some tough decisions we had to make. I think we did pretty well at that. I appreciate Senator Winter's contribution to that commission and her work previously on the School Improvement Fund. And I know there are others behind me that have a great deal of detail to provide you more about this bill.
Senator, thank you so much. I was remiss and didn't ask you to introduce yourself. So.
Well, I was remiss about what is. Jared, gosh, you know, about once a week I do that. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7.
Thank you so much, Senator. No apology necessary. Members, any questions of our colleagues?
Representative Lim. One question, maybe a comment. And I understand, Senator, you took out 25% matching fund. And I think it should be in there, the exception from coastal areas, we might be able to give them without matching fund. Still, if there's a 25% in it, all the district might be able to come up 25%.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I appreciate that, but there are a lot of districts like the coastal districts who are struggling to make ends meet. In fact, I can tell you that my high school, Reedsport High School, has grades 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. All in the same building. And they are struggling. They have done some very innovative things. They've worked with the local hospital, and the hospital comes in and teaches some classes. And these, I was at one of the graduations of these young people, and they got a certificate that allows them to take the nursing board exams. And we're talking 16, 17, 18-year-old kids. So they're doing innovative things, but they don't have the cash to stick up 25%. They've got to have the cash to fix their school. That school's pretty old. It was pretty old when I went there. I'm not going to tell you how many years ago. But, you know, they're struggling to find the money. And one of the other issues that was discussed is the new graduation requirements. And, Representative Lim, you know exactly what I'm talking about, because you and I were behind some of those for the math and the English. And these districts, and now there's even, and the State Board of Education has limited that math to you have to have at least Algebra 1, so you can't have anything less than Algebra 1. So these teachers in the school districts are saying, there's $10 million in the governor's budget to support these new graduation requirements. Do you know what that means to our district under the ADMW and the distribution formula? They get half a teacher, Representative Lim. They get half a teacher, and there's no way they are going to be able to meet these requirements. And then for me to come along and you all to say, you got to cough up another 25% to get a piddly grant, about $208 per ADMW, so you can do some more wonderful things in your district. I just think we're asking way too much of these school districts, and I really appreciate where you're coming from, but I've been there, right there where Representative Roveland knows what I'm talking about.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Roveland.
Yeah, I do. I need to, you know, publicly acknowledge that I meet by phone with a group in Reedsport and another group in Coos Bay a couple times a month, and they had come to me just after the hearing in Reedsport, and it had explained what they had done and where they had gone, and it was only a week later that I got to respond that this was acted on with respect to taking the 25% out. And you cannot believe how shocked, actually, they were to begin with, that it actually could happen like that, and that their input really made a difference, and people saw. And I know that this group here got to hear from that group when they came and talked about the problems that they're having. And the current budget, without these funds for our districts, mean 8 days less than a full year next year in Coos Bay, and variations of that all up and down the coast there. Without the funds that are in this bill, just the other general fund money, there will not be a district that doesn't have to close the school early next year, again in my district.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for listening to us, but I also want to leave you with, as one member of this body, I call myself a part of the Chronologically Advantaged Group. you know, I've probably been either on one side of the aisle, either in the executive branch or the legislative branch since 1969. And I believe that one of the things I would be very remiss, and even my colleagues would be remiss, if they don't bring you some of the historical information on the basis of which we get to from where we were to where we are today. And it's that reason that I came today, because I think when you're making decisions, you make decisions based on the historical information as well as the information that's being brought before you. And so it was with that intent that I came today. I certainly was a member of the Education Excellence Committee. But I also have to add, I know we like to cut and we like to have silos in this building. But, you know, I think at some point we have to look at the bigger, broader picture and how, when we don't do something in early childhood, how that actually works its way through the system to where we have an unintended consequences later. You know, I spent a lot of my time working in public safety and some of those other issues that we all are concerned about, where we are not giving the advantages to our younger population. That's why I made the statement to Governor Kitzhaber that Logan will be three.
because I strongly do believe that our investment has to come at the early end. And I also recognize that all school districts and their funding are not at the same place in our state, and that's our own issue that we have to wrestle and deal with. But I'm asking you to keep these comments in mind as you look at working on the bill, and also keep history in mind. History can also teach us a thing or two as we go forward in making our decision. And with that, I thank you for listening to our testimony.
Thank you, Senator Winter. Senator Rucker, have anything else to do? One closer?
I did. I had one further comment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. There was also, unbeknownst to me, the co-chairs were thinking about making these competitive grants. And when I learned about that on a Sunday morning, reading the newspaper over at the coast, I immediately got on the phone with a number of folks, and I think that's straightened out now. These likewise cannot be competitive grants, because we run into the same problem with some districts not even being able to apply because they just don't have the capacity to do this. So this needs to be fair. It needs to be based on the school distribution formula, the ADMW, and we have accountability written into the bill, and we have flexibility. And, you know, for me, I don't know how you get much better than that other than to appropriate the money, which would be the icing on the cake, and which actually would be the filling in the cake as well. So with that, I think I've taken up plenty of your time.
I just want to thank you both. Thank you both for your extended work on education issues and for this bill before us today. Thank
you're
you
welcome.
Very much.
Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Walt Bloomberg and John Rexford, please.
Chairman Greens, without wanting to be rude, I just wanted to point at the clock and let you know we do have seven other people after you. So just to kind of place you.
I'll hurry up. My name is Walt Blomberg.
I think I did this last time you were here, too. But
that's all right. I'm getting used to it. I'll speak fast. Maybe too fast. If you need me to slow down, let me know. My name is Walt Blomberg. I'm the superintendent of schools in Woodburn, Oregon. Chair Buckley, Vice Chair Comp, Vice Chair Dahlem. Today, I want to let you know how much, first of all, I support the Coalition for School Funding that put together the package that was brought to the Senate and now is before you. I appreciate that it is moving through the legislature and that hopefully one day, in some form, it will be passed. I truly believe in the flexibility of the packaging. In fact, in Woodburn School District, we're doing all-day kindergarten and have for years. We have after-school programs. We have mentoring programs. And there is a cost we've incurred. In fact, over time, it's much greater than we anticipated. We used to use federal funding, and now that that's been restricted and cut back, we are now drawing into our reserves to maintain the programs that this bill asks for. And we're quite concerned about that, as you can imagine. In the fact that I support not only the activities, I support the accountability system, I support the application process, everything in this bill, except for one small thing, and that's where the funding goes. I think a school improvement has been the burden of school districts throughout the state. Of any district, I can tell you that's a heavy burden in some cases to carry. But we're responsible. When the labels get thrown out, when the sanctions happen under NCLB, it's the school districts and not the ESDs that have to account for their actions and the results with students. I think SB 9, which diverts money to the ESD, is probably not the best approach. And I know they were involved in this coalition, but the SB 318 A10 is the one that I am here today to support for some of the reasons I just mentioned. The burden of accountability is strictly solely on the school district's shoulders. I think it is because of that that the money that goes towards school improvement goes directly to the school districts. We can make choices. And in fact, some districts may make choices to spend that money on services that the ESDs provide. And that's not a problem for me, and I think anybody else. But who makes that choice? If the money goes to the ESD,
how are they going to help me provide full-day kindergarten? How are they going to help me mentoring my teacher? How are they going to help me? I have to now figure out where the money is through resolution. It's a convoluted way to get the money to the districts that need it most. I know this isn't a surprise, but we aren't yet funded to the level, the quality level that I think most of us would like. We're not there yet. If we were there, maybe we wouldn't be splitting hairs. Maybe I wouldn't be here today. But the fact is, I'm drawing down my reserves year by year, and have in fact drawn it down half of what it was 2 years ago in order to support the programs that SB 318 supports. And we can't keep doing that. That doesn't mean a whole lot more money to me. You know, it's less than $100,000, obviously. It's not a ton of money. But I should be totally in charge of making choices about how I spend it, and for the accountability reasons I mentioned. So I would appreciate your support of SB 318-A10. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Just a quick question to you. If this does pass in the manner it's currently set in, would that keep you from having to draw down any reserves this year?
No. We'll draw down some, but what it does is stops the bleeding.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome, sir.
Chair Buckley, Vice Chairs Comp and Dallum, members of the committee. My name is John Rexford. I'm the Assistant Superintendent of Operations of the Bend Lapine School District and representing Wisnes District. The proposed state K-12 budget allocation shows a strong belief in Oregon's public school system by Oregon leaders, and we thank you. Today, on behalf of all Oregon public school students, I urge you to continue your commitment to education by funding the School Improvement Fund, as we're discussing, to at least the proposed $260 million level. We strongly believe that your decision to distribute these dollars directly to our school districts will result in the strengthening of our programs and student achievement. East of the Cascades, Bend Lapine Schools have developed a thoughtful, fiscally responsible plan for the dollars that the School Improvement Fund will provide to our students. These dollars will allow us to reduce class size, enhance literacy, increase academic accountability, boost learning, while managing growth for our nearly 16,000 students. Local school districts like ours will continue to measure results, as we've been doing for many years. We can and we will account for these dollars separately, demonstrate how we're using these dollars to improve student success, provide annual assessments of students and programs to prove that your decision to directly allocate these funds to local school districts is in fact in the best interest of Oregon public school students. We advocate that you continue to keep the accountability of the programs and classes supported by the School Improvement Fund directly in the hands of those that deliver the programs, local school districts. At Bend Lapine Schools, we've developed a plan to directly invest these dollars to further student success. And simply said, we won't be able to do these things for our students without your help. Senator Winters will be happy to hear that our number one priority is to have students reading by the end of grade one. We think that's key to that success. And along with that goal, our investment would be to reduce class sizes, kindergarten and first grade to 18-1, in grades 2 to 20-1, and return as close as possible to the staffing levels of the 2001-2 school year for our other grades, 3-12. Those class sizes are still running large, but we're going to put our money where our mouth is, where kids need to learn to read. We'll also be completing purchase of instructional materials at all levels, including technology resources for student learning, continue to expand what we call literacy grants to our schools to enhance building level training and focus, increase library book allocations, restore counseling ratios to support at-risk and students who need support, expand other alternative options, and much more. At Bend Lapine, we'll use nearly 90% of the funds that you've allocated to directly hire and support teachers for the classroom. The balance of the resources will be to provide needed school supplies and materials, library books, textbooks for classrooms. We propose an efficient and effective use of valuable public resources, no overhead, no indirect costs, no waste. This is an exciting time to be an Oregonian and to be a member of the public school family. I'm the second generation of my family to work in public school systems, and I'm a little bit passionate about it. This is an exciting time after being in the business for 22 years. It's been a bumpy ride. I think we've got an opportunity to make history, and I thank you for your support.
It's great to hear your passion, sir. Any quick questions? Thank you both so much for being here and offering your testimony today. It's greatly appreciated.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your work.
Mr. Olson.
Lori Wimmer Whalen, David Williams, Chuck Bennett, please.
I just come up anyway, and Ozzie too. You can all come up if you want. You can find a way to
Trisha Smith and Ozzie Rose
get five seats around that. More than welcome. Scenic designer on this one. Welcome.
Good afternoon, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing Oregon Education Association. I've brought up some of my closest friends with me today. We are part of a coalition that formed in August of 2006 to create a unified goal for public policy and school funding for K-12 in Oregon, and to bring to you this bill, which we promised you in February, was winging its way to you, and it is here, and it's a very good day today. We're very pleased to be able to ask you to support Senate Bill 318 with our Dash 9 amendments. I've handed out to you several items, and I'd like to go through what they are and why I'm giving them to you. As I said, our coalition began in August 2006 on the heels of 7 years of disinvestment in K-12. That was about $1.2 billion. That's nearly $1,800 a student. We came forward with what we consider to be a centerpiece of our both policy and financial ask, which was, it's found in this green brochure, which you have, and it identifies all of the elements in the new and improved school improvement plan as brought by the Senate Educational Excellence Commission and their work in the last interim, as well as other ideas that we knew were out there with respect to class size reduction, literacy, early grades investments, dropout prevention, and so on and so forth. We've actually itemized each of those as a menu on a per-student expense basis so that you can look at it just as you would a restaurant menu and see what your dollars buy. The co-chair's budget is not $6.3 billion. Their recommendation is $6.245 billion. Of that, $260 million would fund this bill in their view of the world. That's about $171 a student. But that still buys a number of the kinds of ideas that we identify in this green brochure. You also had submitted by me in the previous discussion on House Bill 2612, which was a similar proposal vying for your love, as this one is, a chart that looks like this, and you'll find it in that file if you look at it, because it had a lot of elements of both that concept and this, and some of those concepts are in the A11 amendment. We asked districts to imagine how they might invest that $171 a student. What would they do for the next 2 years if you all do pass this bill, and also if Ways and Means should send out a budget that includes this money? And that is there is a budget bill that is a companion to this, by the way, in Ways and Means. It's House Bill 5021. And you have this cream-colored booklet that was prepared by our coalition as well. And we had responses from 23 districts from around the state. They are large, small, urban, rural, suburban. They represent school districts in about half the legislature's, a little more than half the legislature's districts. So I think it gives you a good flavor for what school districts might do with this money. Now, obviously, they all have to go through their budget committees and so on, but they illustrate in a very concrete way to you precisely what it is that we had in mind when we came forward with this proposal. We also worked with both the co-chairs on their concerns about how to measure accountability with respect to this. We believe that the School Improvement Fund and Senate Bill 318, which is the updated improved version of the School Improvement Fund,
already had plenty of accountability assurances in it, but they, the co-chairs were interested in seeing how those elements related to the key benchmarks by the Department of Ed. So you have a copy also of a memorandum sent out by two of our organizations to the co-chairs proposing how we would align those elements in the School Improvement Fund to the 15 key benchmarks so that that performance can be tracked. We've tried to integrate everything together that has already been done in the law before, as well as the vision as we move forward, so that it all makes sense, so it's maximally accountable, so that it grants the flexibility you heard Senator Walker talking about. And to that point, I would make one point. Senator Winters was right. I was part of that effort early on for the original School Improvement Fund, and at that time we had just had the big Education Leadership Summit that talked about if you had one place to spend a tiny bit of money as a modest first step toward achievement of the quality education model, what might it be? And the early investment was seen as the first place to go. That point was made so convincingly, though, I would stipulate that even after the first year that money was all there was, and then it was removed as we headed into recession, school districts still use their operation dollars for those investments because they agreed it was so essential. That's precisely why we need to have a bigger list without penalizing districts and allowing them to perhaps target those school improvement resources elsewhere. They've already targeted, in many cases, those dollars to the early investments, and therefore, if you offer them a broader and more flexible list, they can respond, because 197 districts coped with these cuts, 197 different ways, they can respond more nimbly to their particular needs on the ground. In some cases, they have a high English language learner population. In other cases, they have a very high dropout rate. In other places, they have a need for things that are more reflective of their community priorities, whether it be more investment in career and professional technical programs or what have you. That's their call, and it ought to be. You can't know them all. And one size does not fit all. With respect to not only that issue of accountability, but various other issues, we ultimately decided that this bill needed to be revised. You'll see in that memo, it was our understanding, it was our misunderstanding that ESDs were already included in the law. And the reason we felt it was important that they be included in the law is that, particularly in small districts, it's going to be tough for them to do all the measurement of the performance benchmarks and so on and so forth and do all the reporting that's required as part of their accountability for the use of this money. It's a little bit of money over a short period of time, and in tiny districts, that's a burden. And so we felt that the ESDs would be particularly helpful in providing that support and have asked that, as well as the other accountability language that came out of the bill itself, be a part of that budget note for 5021. We also believe that because this legislature in 05 just changed the mandates to the ESDs with respect to what it is their core mission is supposed to be about, and added explicitly helping districts with school improvement, that this would be a logical, again, an integrated and logical way to loop them into the expectations as far as your education vision for K-12. So in the dash nines, you will find, as your committee administrator has pointed out, that we ask that ESDs be added. That's about $8 a student, just so you know. It's a very tiny piece of that 171. That the optional monetary rewards, which was a concept for offering merit, which is on pages 2 and 3 of the bill, on page 2, it's lines 18 through 20, and page 3, lines 13 through 15, be removed so that it all goes to school improvement. We don't need monetary awards. It really seemed like an odd fit. We asked that the distribution of the dollars be fixed. In the initial law, it said that you take your total ADMW and divide it by the amount of money in the pot, or maybe it's the other way around. But in any case, if any districts didn't apply for the grant, that would be money left on the table. And we thought that didn't make sense. So we're asking that it be divided by the total ADMW of the grantees so that everybody who is awarded a grant splits the pot. And then finally, as you've heard, the bill as it came over from the Senate belatedly got a $243,000 fiscal impact because of the extra accountability work that was going to be required of the department. And so we just removed that offending language, went back to the original accountability requirements of the district that are, I mean, of the department that were in the law initially, and that removed the problem, and the department has assured me that that brings the fiscal down to zero. So with that, you will notice what the bill is not. Doesn't have competitive grants in it. It doesn't require the districts to match or be penalized 20%. It doesn't have a top-down micromanagement philosophy. And we're glad about that. We'd hope that you would agree that those are good things for it not to have. We would also point out that we oppose specifically the Dash A11s that are before you because it will still have the $243,000 fiscal impact in that version. And as I said, it would cut 20% out of the total amount of the state school improvement grant for any school that can't meet the nebulous language in that grant about the research. I would argue that with respect to that piece, educational research has a ways to go out there as far as measurable outcomes. There are even proposals that are in the competing bill. For example, the K-1 class size buy down. There are educational researchers that say that you get a fade-out effect if you don't go K-3 with your class size buy down. So, you know, there's a lot in there as far as traps, I would say, that districts would, in effect, take 20% cut if the A11s were adopted. So we're asking you to please pass 318A with the Dash 9s and only the Dash 9s. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Pamela, if I could ask your indulgence, we're obviously not going to be able to get to a work session today. I'd like to give chalkboard folks a chance to at least introduce their amendment. We will reschedule or we'll schedule or as soon as possible next week to work this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the Chalkboard Project, and I say wow because I'm absolutely thrilled, Mr. Chair, that you had the courtesy of letting us to testify and just briefly tell you about our amendments.
Wait, and I'm sorry, I do hope you'll come back to next week when we
meet. Yes, but the first and foremost, I must say I'm absolutely galled by the statement that we're trying to penalize schools. And that many of the schools have already made targeted investments. We congratulate schools that have done that. And this does not penalize or require a match by anyone who simply wants to use the school improvement fund to pay for programs that we know achieve student outcome success. That's it. That's all we're asking. And the QEC department can decide what that is. As a matter of fact, in the original school improvement bill, House Bill 2298, it used the same nebulous conversation as far as targeting towards math and reading for third and fifth graders. It also left it up to the department to make a decision as to which programs would assist in reading and math. All we have said in this bill and the Dash 11 amendments, very simply, and John will give you the evidence, I'm giving you the emotion, which I know I shouldn't do, but I absolutely cannot help it. The only thing we want to do is simply give schools an incentive to use the money for things that we already know are proven practices and increase student achievement. That's all we're asking. You can expand 318 in the list as broadly as you want, but if it's something that's more experimental or not so sure, I don't think a 20% match is burdensome. That's all we're asking. And then we can go back to the people of the state and tell them that we, in fact, got some accountability for their tax dollars because we gave schools an incentive to focus it where children will benefit from it the most. And if, in fact, it's already done, they still get the money. There's a section in here that makes it very clear that if you've already done these things, you still get 100% of the money. You can apply it for 100% of the money for anything you want. We're just giving a little gray area where the department or the QEC can say, you know what, we're not sure that's going to work. You have to pay for 20% of it. That's it. It's simple. It's logical. It's John.
Hi, John.
Hi. Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is John Taponia. I'm a managing director of Echo Northwest.
in Portland, and just wanted to make a couple of observations. There's a PowerPoint presentation that I've handed out. I think the question before this committee and largely before the legislature generally is, how do you make the education money matter? You're in a unique position right now where you have some additional resources to invest. And frankly, from my perspective, I think it's one of the last opportunities you're going to have before the baby boomers come crashing down in your budgets over the course of the next three decades and ballot measure 11 continues to chip away at the rest of the general fund. My general observations are on the second substantive slide. Generally, I think that Senate Bill 318 is a good framework. It is moving toward this direction of targeting some investments outside the state school fund. It's an excellent general approach. But as Senator Walker mentioned, she said that the genesis of this was the state of Pennsylvania. So let's take a look at how Pennsylvania has fared thus far under the Pennsylvania Accountability Block Grant. So you turn to the next slide, which has bar graphs on it, you'll see that in the 2005-06 mid-year report out of Pennsylvania, about 60% of the money was invested in full-day kindergarten, $117 million in that year out of roughly $200 million. So about 60% with the list that's generally comparable to the list that is in Senate Bill 318. Now let's turn the slide to the next page. Why would we caution against a major expansion of full-day kindergarten? You can look at the two quotes. One that comes out of the RAND Corporation from December 06. There appears to be growing evidence that attendance in full-day kindergarten programs is not associated with long-term academic benefits. So in essence, if you pass this unamended, you're potentially launching, if Pennsylvania or Oregon turns out the same as Pennsylvania, a $150 million biennial investment in full-day kindergarten 4 months after the RAND Corporation has told you that there's little evidence of long-term benefits of that investment. I think that would be poor public policy, and I think it would be a poor investment on the part of the state. Thank you.
John, thanks so much. Are you available to come back?
Yes.
Dr. Spence, thank you so much. Thank you for your patience. I look forward to continuing the discussion. Members, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 318A. I'm going to be adding work sessions to the following bills to next week's agenda: Senate Bill 214A, Senate Bill 318A, Senate Joint Memorial 12, Senate Bill 23A, and Senate Bill 392A. The exact dates will be announced by Mr. Olson as soon as we've worked out the schedule. Thank you for your time and attention this afternoon, and we are adjourned.